Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're going to take you back to high school on the program today with the author of a book that I enjoyed very much. It's titled My Homecoming Dance, Reflections on Teaching in Wisconsin. And the author with me in the studio today, Sue Leamy-Kies, is a retired high school English teacher from Platteville. She's published poetry, essays, movie reviews, short stories, a play. But this is her full-length book, first one, My Homecoming Dance, as her first full-length book. And are you a teacher? If you are one, maybe you could let us know what's great and not so great about being a teacher. And if you aren't a teacher, maybe you could, you'd like to call in with a love letter to a teacher. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Sue Leamy-Kies, welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Larry. I'm just so excited to be here.
You know, I was reading the book. I was thinking, well, this would be a great book for teachers, those who want to teach and retired teachers. And then I thought, you know what? It's also a great book for anybody who went to high school.
Yeah.
Because it brought, in my own mind, it brought back a lot of my own experiences, both teaching, but then also in high school. But maybe you can give us an overview, for those who haven't read it yet, of what people can expect when they give it a read.
Sure. I wrote the book kind of as an ode to teachers. It documents my teaching experience, but I don't think unless you actually teach, it's like any occupation, you don't know the occupation, but I think we see teachers because we all have them, but we don't know what they actually do. So in my book, I talk about my teaching experiences and some of the funny things that happened, some of the more serious things that happened, and I relate it through stories. But I also go full circle because I tell stories about the high school where I taught, but that's also the high school I graduated from, Platteville High School. So it's got a whole element of layers to it.
It's pretty cool to be able to teach where you once went to school. And I found your comments on that really interesting and a lot of times really fun.
Thank you.
And laugh out loud funny sometimes. Tell us about Platteville. There's a lot of people who don't know Platteville or where it is, and so it's southwestern Wisconsin. And
right. Platteville is in southwestern Wisconsin. We're just over the Mississippi River from Dubuque, Iowa, about 22 miles, and about 70 miles from Madison, down in that little corner of the state. When they built Highway 151 and made it, you know, a big, fancy four-lane interstate, I can remember the governor at the time, I think it was Tommy Thompson, said, oh, we're building a highway to nowhere. But we kind of like to think it's somewhere. And the UW-Platteville is a real big draw to Platteville. It makes us kind of who we are. They recently won an award, I think, lately, so for being one of the best small universities.
Yeah. And and it's a kind of a rural community in many ways. I mean, you've got this center, Platteville, where you've got the university and education as well for everybody. But it's rural in nature, isn't it?
Yes, it's very rural. And when I was younger, growing up there, it was much more rural than it is now. But farmers made up a big portion of what used to be in the school system, like in my class, when I was in grade school, we had 50 kids in a class. And then that was our Catholic school. Then the grade school had more than that. And then there was another elementary school over at the university called the lab school. So we had a lot of kids. In fact, my class was 210 students, my graduating class from Platteville. And now they're probably at 140. So it's very rural still. But now there are corporate farms and big dairies and such that have changed the
nature.
Look of Platteville.
Yeah, the look of it.
Yeah.
And you were actually a farmer, just as one more aside before you were a farmer after graduating high school.
From high school, yes. I married a farmer.
Yeah.
My grandparents farmed, and then I married a farmer, and we farmed outside of Platteville, and then for a few years over near Bloomington, Wisconsin, in Glen Haven. So, yes, I'm familiar with farming, and I could relate to the kids who had to get up and milk the cows and do the chores and then quick go in and shower and get to school. And we still, when I was teaching, had a few of those students who, you know, did that.
Lots of, and, you know, you finally decided to go to school to be a teacher. And, I mean, it was a lot of hard work, as I know there were a lot of summer schools and evening classes and whatnot to get you through because you had the other job.
Yes, yes. It took me 5 years. I went back to school when I was 31, and we were farming at the time. And I just thought, well, I want to get a career going here. So I did go back to school, and it was a lot of work. It really was. Mm-hmm. But, boy, was it worth it.
Yeah, and you landed, because you were living in that area, you really wanted to teach there, I would assume.
Yes. I had some interviews away, but we really wanted to stay in the Platteville area if we could. Our kids were going to school there and that. So, yeah, we stayed in that area and enjoyed being able to go to school and do the farming thing, too. So, yeah.
We need to talk about your time. You started, I mean, there were so many potential teachers out there or people who were looking for jobs. So, I mean, you started as kind of a part-timer or a sub-teacher, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I did. I kind of look at it as I wiggled my way in. There were 250 to 300 applicants for every teaching job when I graduated in 1991. I graduated from UW-Platteville. And so I was very disappointed at first when I couldn't find a job. There just weren't very many openings. So I kind of wiggled my way in as a teacher's aide in the special education department. And it turned out to be one of the best things that ever happened. You know, it's kind of funny when you're going through it, you think it's just, you know, you're disappointed. But boy, that was wonderful because I worked with a woman named Jane who was an absolutely wonderful teacher. And I dedicate a chapter in the book to her, actually a couple chapters, because she was a wonderful mentor and a wonderful teacher.
Seemed like an extraordinary person.
She was just absolutely wonderful. And a few years ago, probably four now, she passed away of cancer. But she leaves a legacy, let me tell you. Yep.
I want to talk some more about her, but Mike in Green Bay is up with a comment about teaching, I believe. Mike, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hey, hello. So just very quickly, I'm sitting here with my attack beagle, Kaiser, so if he barks, I'll get off the phone. But my mentor teacher was Mrs. Kordemeyer, and I just thought of her when, the lady was talking. I'm retired 15 years. I loved every minute of it. And I was a severely emotionally disturbed teacher, or my kids were. Well, I was severely emotionally disturbed too, but I loved them. I can still remember them. I'm glad I taught when I did. Mrs. Kordemeyer, I get emotional just thinking about her. First day I saw her, she said, "Now come here, sonny. I'm going to tell you how to do this." My wife is a teacher. She's retiring in 5 weeks. And, if you haven't walked in our shoes, you better get in the classroom and see what we really do. Because we're social workers, parents, teachers, and we love kids. And anybody that thinks differently is making a mistake. And we're a vocation. We are not an occupation. So, just...
Mike, thank you very much for calling. Well, comment maybe on what Mike had to say there.
Oh, Mike, thank you and your wife for both being teachers. And yes, Jane, the woman I was talking about, worked with ED kids. So I know right what you're talking about. She showed me patience. She taught me how to deal with kids who really don't want to be in school and kids who don't have past experiences that are positive. So we had to try and turn that around. And Jane was just a wonderful person. So thank you for calling in.
You know, this is probably a good point for me to mention. I have, you know, I taught for my whole career here at the University of Wisconsin. I had so much respect for public school, high school, grade school teachers because thinking in my own situation, every student I taught graduated in the top 10% of their high school class. They're paying a lot of money to be there. They picked my class. And that's the range of students that you or any public teacher deals with now is, I just admire your ability to have done that.
Well, thank you. That was always kind of the challenge, I should say, because not only were they, you know, in school and maybe some of them didn't want to be, but English classes required all 4 years. So some of them, the last thing they wanted to do was take English. So it was my job to kind of pull them in. And that's what I tried to do. But it was always so much fun at the beginning of every year to look out there and see all those bright faces and wonder who I had in front of me and what the year was going to bring. And it was just almost like Christmas. You know?
I know that feeling as well. And I understand it for sure. You were student council advisor early on. So funny stories. The student council advisor usually goes to somebody, the youngest one, if I'm not mistaken, probably in any school.
Yeah, student council advisor was a challenge. And I had followed a person who'd done it for quite a few years, Mr. Rob Saris, and he was wonderful at it. So when I came after him, I thought, oh my gosh, how am I going to do this? He was a coach and brought a lot to it that I was afraid I wouldn't be able to. But the one thing they put us in charge of was the homecoming dance. And so that brought a lot of different elements to planning and what are the kids going to do? And they would come up with ideas of things to do that didn't always go as planned.
He had one involving pigs.
Yeah. Oh, that was interesting. Yeah, we decided to have a kiss the pig contest, or I should say the kids did. And the PETA people got word of it, and they weren't happy that we were kissing the pig. It was putting too much stress on the pig, and they ended up protesting outside the high school.
And by the way, this was a fundraiser event for libraries?
Oh, this was for homecoming.
Homecoming, okay.
Yeah, it was just a homecoming event. And the fundraiser that we had, that's good. I don't remember what the money went for, but it was a fundraiser. And kids would put money in the jar of the person, faculty member, they wanted to kiss the pig at the homecoming rally. And so it turned out our vice principal won, and I had to go pick up the pig at a neighboring farm, and that little pig kind of made a mess in the restroom in the high school. Yeah, anyway.
Well, he did what pigs do.
Yes, he did what pigs do. Mm-hmm. But it went off really well in the end, and it was okay, but it was a funny experience.
Samantha in Whitehall, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Samantha.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Love your show. Anyways, I had three things. I had a kindergarten teacher. I'm 43 now, but I had a kindergarten teacher, Mrs. Olson. She passed away, umpteen years ago for Delta Elementary. And she really, really worked with the students and loved the students and taught them this old man and, you know, all this different stuff. And then when I got into high school, well, I was in special ed all my life. When I was in high school, I had a teacher, Michael Dunn, at Gaylectric Templo, who really was inspiring to, you know, teach the students and be able to help you, because I was told that I'd have to graduate 2 years after my class in 2000 because I wasn't catching up. Well, I was like, by golly, I'm going to get this done, and he helped. Plus, my grandma was a school teacher before she retired at 65, when you had to retire back in the day. And she really helped, too, to get you to learn and made learning fun. You didn't even know you were learning. So that gave me my love of learning, even though I never went on to college. It always helped me to, like, read and write and do things that with ADHD that some people thought I'd never do. So just wanted to get myself to all of them. One's dead. The others, well, two of them are gone, and the other's retired. So.
Well, Samantha, thank you so much for that story. Or your remembrances. A comment, Sue?
Well, bless the kindergarten teachers out there, because I remember my kindergarten teacher, too. I think, you know, if they can get us all off to a good start, that's wonderful. Because we all the rest of us teachers, we build on what happens in the younger grades. And as far as your high school teacher that made learning fun, oh, my gosh, that's what I strive to do. I mean, not all learning can be fun. There's work involved, too. But I thought if I can make it fun for the kids, it was fun for me, too. But that takes a lot of planning as well. So I just want people to understand, to make learning fun, teachers work hard to do that. So thanks.
I know you took it upon yourself to teach the kids a lot of new vocabulary words. One of your favorite stories related to one of your favorite words, gullible.
Yes, that was an interesting, I'll never forget that. That was one day we were doing the vocabulary words. I did five every week along with some literary terms. And because I figure you have to know the basics, kind of like you learn the scales to, you know, play music, you have to learn the basics of the language in order to use it appropriately. So anyway, one of the weeks, gullible was the word. And one day, one of the students pointed out to me that someone had written gullible on the ceiling. And I would tell kids, now don't look at the ceiling. You don't want to cheat now. And I had one young man, Vinny, and he refused to look at the ceiling because he thought we were trying to pull one on him, you know? And we'd say, no, Vinny, it's really up there. And the kids were trying. He refused to look. He was mad because he thought we were pulling his leg. So it taught the word perfectly, and everybody got it right that day. So
Denise emailed us. Denise is a retired elementary teacher from Platteville, now living in Minnesota. And your book was Denise's reading during recovery from spinal surgery. And Denise enjoyed all the memories of special people in the Platteville schools and says thanks for a wonderful book, Sue.
Well, thank you, Denise. And I hope you're doing well now and recovered. And I appreciate you reading the book. And, yeah, Platteville's a good place to teach, right?
And I hope a lot of I hope a lot of people read your book, but I hope a lot
of
former teachers read the book because and current teachers read the book because it tells us so much about life. But at the same time, if you're like me, when you're reading it, you're going to remember your own stories from school that really brought back some fine memories for me as both a teacher and thinking back to my own days as a student. When I signed up for typing class, because typically it was all girls took typing. And I thought, well, here I could be in a class with all girls. So I signed up for typing. It does remind me of the technology, too, because when I took it, I mean, it was an old Smith Corona, push hard.
Yep. The manual typewriters, yeah. The electric typewriters just came into being when I was in high school. We had two of them in the room, and we'd all run to get there and try and get the electric typewriters. So, yeah, typing was a big deal.
Erica in Lake Tomahawk, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Erica.
Good morning. I just wanted to give a shout-out to Sister Mary Andrew, who was quite possibly one of the meanest teachers I've ever known. She and I did not hit it off. But when I was in the second or third grade, she told me I was going to wind up being a truck driver. Like, that was a fate worse than death. I'm 71. I'm still driving truck, and I could not be happier.
Well, good for you.
Oh, Eric, thank you so much for that call. Well, sometimes what the teacher tells you you're going to be turns out that way, and sometimes it doesn't.
It's very true. I had one student, and we teachers have to be careful of that, but he was late for everything. And he didn't have his homework done sometimes, you know, and his big thing was football. This isn't in the book, but I remember telling him, I said, you know, I won't say his name, but there's more to life than football, you know. And he kind of looked at me, and he ended up playing pro ball down in Miami. So sometimes teachers just, we don't know.
And probably was, I'm thinking about the amount of money that he was making.
Yep.
Versus what a teacher makes.
Yep.
And it's quite a difference. What are your most treasured items in your classroom? And some funny stories about it. Was the stapler? Now, why the heck the stapler, and what was, tell us a story relating to that.
Well, I would have staplers, and having taught sophomores and juniors, they tend to, like, wham down on the stapler, and every year the stapler would break. And I got very, very frustrated after buying a new stapler, because our teacher money that we used to buy these things was sacred. I mean, we didn't have a lot of it. So I thought, I'm going to splurge one year, and I bought an electric stapler. And so you just feed the paper into the automatic electric stapler, and wham, it staples. And so I would have students who would be kind of afraid of that and such. But before that, when I had the staplers that broke all the time, then I'd have students that would want to fix them. Especially the boys. They'd take it down to the tech ed room. I can fix this. And they'd bring it back, and most of the time it wasn't fixed. It was not good. And I think I said in the book it goes to the cemetery in the back of the school where we throw all the dead staplers. But it always brought a lot of fun with the stapler.
Yeah, and the electric one.
Yeah. Yeah, one girl always jumped whenever she stapled it. She could never get used to that.
Oh, Samantha emailed us. She's a teacher educator at UW-Madison and wants to give a lot of love of her to her student teachers this semester, especially Amy and Johnny. They're two of the most loving and caring special ed teachers Samantha's had the honor to work with. Strong teachers support strong teachers.
That's very, very true. I had many student teachers, and I learned so much from them, and I hope they learned from me. And when I was, you know, learning to teach, my student teacher or my teacher mentees were very important to me. So I tried to pass that on. And that's how you learn, is by going in the classroom, interacting with the kids, and then having someone give you a few little hints along the way. And that is so important, to have a mentor. It really is.
Linda in Platteville. Hi, Linda.
Hello. I'm calling because Sue was probably teaching in 2010 when Act 10 came about. And I wanted to have her address the effect of that on education, because education is also political.
Yeah, and you do have a really interesting chapter on Act 10. You want to talk about it?
Yeah, thanks for calling, Linda. Yeah, and I think it was 2011, if I'm not. I think that's right. But yeah, Governor Walker passed the budget repair bill, also known as Act 10, and it was absolutely devastating to teachers. It was about midway through my teaching. And I can't tell you how, like, a punch in the gut that felt like. Because teachers who were on our negotiating board back when we could negotiate in collective bargaining, would bargain for you know, getting better, you know, conditions. And what they did was, I know people who were on our bargaining team, they took lower wages in lieu of getting some better benefits. So when Act 10 came along, Governor Walker pointed out all the wonderful benefits teachers got, but yet, you know, we had bargained for those and got less money, you know, in the bargain for it, because it was cheaper for our school districts. And so not only that, you know, it was less money, but it also kind of took away the prestige of being a teacher. It didn't, it made us seem like we weren't as good as other professions. And it was very devastating. And we're still recovering. I hope we do. But you know how I told you when we had 250 to 300 applicants for all the jobs? Now they're lucky to get three or four. And the teacher programs, they're in the colleges, there aren't as many people going into teaching. And that's, again, devastating. So, yeah, Act 10 had a big effect, and I hope we can recover it from it. It really affects public education.
Sue in Marshfield emailed us. In 10th grade, she was reeling from her mother's untimely death, and her father was also grieving, of course. Sue said she was rather aimless about the future. And then Miss Vogel, her sophomore year biology teacher and also a high school counselor, recognized her potential. Sue was called into her office, wondering what she'd done wrong. Instead, Miss Vogel outlined Sue's path to college. And she's forever grateful for Miss Vogel's intervention because she ended up graduating from UW-La Crosse. Her teacher's encouragement led to her future success. And Sue says she is forever grateful to Miss Vogel.
Oh, that's wonderful, Sue. I am so happy for you. And two things there, going through loss. I have a chapter in my book about going through losses that can be absolutely devastating. I lost students through, you know, as time went on. I lost peers that passed away, and our own son passed away. Going through those things can be devastating, and you have to learn to go on afterwards. And I'm so thrilled you had support in a teacher counselor that helped you with that. And I know I tried to help students, you know, with that too, and tried to help them find their way. So I'm glad you found teaching.
Yeah, I was thinking about that and relating to what you had to go through as well, because I lost a daughter, Lauren, which I can't even talk about, in the middle of a semester.
Oh.
And it was a very hard time. But the students helped me a lot.
Yes. I on one hand, our son passed away in August. It'll be 20 years this August. And I didn't know how I was going to go back to teaching in September. I just didn't know if I could do it. And somehow I did, and I got there, and I had support of people around me, and our superintendent was supportive of me. Dr. Jacobson was supportive of me. He was our principal, and my students were wonderful, just wonderful. And it is hard. And then once I got back in, I was glad I had something to think about. I don't know if that worked that way for you, Larry, but you have something there to go back to.
Yeah. Jen in Madison emailed us. Jen wants to shout out to a couple of teachers. Mrs. Petruska, a teacher at Mendota Elementary in Madison. She creates an atmosphere that feels like a party where she diligently and lovingly teaches them the very important art of reading in second grade. The other teacher is Mr. Bester at One City Schools in Monona. The man would do literally anything to help a child. The best thing that he does is teach them the habits of character required to be a good human being in this world. And he does it with so much grace and kindness. He leaves Jen speechless, and she often tears up when she talks about him and how much he means to her family.
Oh, that's very moving. I can totally relate in that if a teacher doesn't care about the students know that. And the caring relationship is number one. It really is. I mean, not that you want to become their best friends or their, you know, but they need to know that you are there for them. You're there to teach content, but you're there to teach them first. And if they don't have the Maslow's hierarchy of needs comes to mind. They have to have, you know, food, clothing, caring, all that needs to take place before you can, you know, learn effectively. So, yes, that relationship with students is top. That's above everything.
And when it comes to parents, you had an interesting point. So you said there are three kinds of parents: uninvolved, supportive is second, and third is overzealous. So you've got every between, and you said that the numbers of it used to be the number two, the supportive, when you started, but that's changed over time.
Yes, over time, it's kind of interesting because I also say, or I think, that schools are kind of a microcosm of what we see in society. And now with, like, great income divisions, you know, you have the haves, the have-nots, and the middle class is kind of dwindled. And that has happened, I believe, intellectually as well. So you have uninvolved parents who are struggling. It's all they can do to kind of take care of themselves and make sure food's on the day. It's very hard for them to help their kid make school a priority. And then you have the overzealous parents who want their kids to do, and I understand this, but they want their kids to do, they want a 4.0, they want their kid to get scholarships, they want their kid, and they can get sometimes a little pushy to the point where the kids are feeling very stressed. And so that can be a problem sometimes. And the good old middle, like when I was, you know, I hate to sound like my grandpa, you know, in those good old days, but, you know, that middle class, that middle of the road where, yes, school is important. You're going to go to school and behave because, you know, we expect you to do that. Just that supportiveness of education and school and teachers. That's really what teachers need, is that middle place.
Support.
Yep, support.
Let's talk about tech. I mean, there's so many things we haven't talked about. There's so many funny stories and interesting stories but a couple of the things that I wanted to touch on. One is a technology, and we mentioned in passing, but how have you seen the new technologies, internet and everything else, change the classroom?
Oh, it has. That's the biggest change. Students and what they need to learn basically doesn't change, I don't think. They need you to care. They need, you know, but technology is so important. And I love technology, but boy, it's hard to draw the line as to, you know, there's so much to choose from in technology. I remember when we first got email at our school and students would sneak into the computer lab to check their email. Because it was before phones, and we had to lock the doors to the computer lab because they were running in there to check their email. So I actually saw it from the beginning, from, you know, the machine, you know, like, what do you call those?
Manual typewriter.
Typewriters, and now we have copy machines that do everything, and the kids have phones, and I know a lot of schools. That became a problem toward the end of my teaching. Every kid had a phone, and then even then everybody got a Chromebook. And to try and keep them on task when those things are in front of them becomes a problem. But the things that technology can do for students when used appropriately is just, it's absolutely amazing. So we have to, and I heard someone on talking yesterday on public radio about the artificial intelligence. That's very helpful, too, but we're going to have to learn how to use it appropriately. It's important kids know how to use it because when they go in the workplace, it's going to be there. But it's hard for teachers to know, you know, what to teach and how much technology to use and when to rein it in.
So a couple of things. relating to potential teachers, and let's take early career teachers. What would you recommend to early career teachers?
Early career teachers, I can remember when I first started, is to just keep in mind that you are, number one, a learner. You're a forever learner. So you are going to be learning along with the students. And when you first start teaching, that is going to help you if you remember that, because you will have to break things down in order to teach them. And you will learn from year to year. Every year I would kind of take note of the things that worked and the things that didn't. So if something worked, and if you don't try new things, you're not going to learn.
Yeah.
So trying new things is important. And I always tried to, you know, keep up and try something new. And if it didn't work, kind of tweak it. So new teachers, just I think it's really important to remember that, number one, you are a learner as well as your students are, and keep on trying to make it better.
Is that what makes a great teacher? I mean, what makes a great teacher?
That's a good question. I think one of the things that a great teacher brings to the job is their personality. Because we've all had, I know in our school, not the same teacher doesn't hit it off with everyone. There are various teachers there for a reason, because that way students can hit it off with other, you know, mm-hmm. find somebody who fits their learning style, their personality. So I think, number one, a teacher's got to remember that you need to bring you to the job. Let the kids get to know who you are, bring your strengths, but also work on your weaknesses. But don't be afraid to bring your strengths to the job, and don't think you have to be like everybody else. Don't compare yourself to everybody else. Do the job that you know you can do, and learn from other people, but implement what works for you.
You know, an email from a listener who taught elementary school for many years and found through all the ups and downs, no matter how difficult the day was, there was joy every single day. Each word was a sentence. Every single day there was joy.
That is so true. I got so much joy out of my job. There were a lot of challenges. There were a lot of work. There was a lot of work. There was heartache sometimes. But the joy was there. The students, like I said, when they catch on to something, and I know this is kind of cliche, but their eyes light up and they, oh my gosh, I did that. Or they get finished with a speech that they did a good job on and they're so thrilled. And even the fact they stood up in front of the class and gave the speech sometimes was a milestone. That's why I'm glad I wrote the book, because I recorded the joy that I felt through all those years, and I am really glad I did that.
I'm glad you did, too. I very much enjoyed reading your book, and I hope a lot of people get a chance to read it, Sue.
Oh, thank you.
The title of the book is My Homecoming Dance, and the subtitle, Reflections on Teaching in Wisconsin. How do we get a copy?
Good question. It's published by the Wisconsin Writers Association, so you can go to wiwrite.org, or you can go to Barnes & Noble and Amazon. It's on there. Mm-hmm. And please, if you go to your library and your bookstore and they don't have it, please request it so they get it. I also have a website that if you emailed me on the email on my website, I would send you a copy. My website is SueLeemyKies.com.
K-I-E-S.
Yes.
Your last name is spelled Sue.
SueLeemyKies.com.
A pleasure, Sue. Thank you so much for spending some time with us. I hope you sell a lot of books. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Larry. It's been fun.
Sue Leemyekies, our guest. Her book, My Homecoming Dance, and you're going to laugh a lot, but there's some tears that can come in that book as well. But you're going to also recall a lot of your own experiences growing up in school. And you'll think about teachers that had an impact on you. And, you know, we're going to turn our attention to another kind of a teacher, a tutor who helps in adult literacy in Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining us today on WPR News. We're turning our attention, turning our attention now to another kind of teacher, a tutor who's helping a neighbor improve their reading or writing skills, talking about adult literacy today on the show. And we're visiting with two guests from the Literacy Network. It's an organization in Dane County helping 55,000 adults with low literacy, and a couple of guests for you. Bex Fabrizio is the director of English as a Second Language group classes at Literacy Network. And Bex, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
With us as well, it's great to have you here, Bex. Thank you. Marie Nibby is our other guest, is Director of Adult Basic Education Programming and GED Instruction at Literacy Network. And Marie, thank you as well for joining in.
Hello, thank you.
We appreciate having you both with us today. And as we talk with our experts today, I hope you'll join in. What do you want to know about the effect of raising literacy rates, for example? Maybe does your community have a program to help people learn the skills to be successful? You can call us at 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Marie, let's start with you. Tell us more about the Literacy Network. What do you do and who do you help?
Well, I oversee our essential literacy tutoring program, working with adults who want to build basic skills in reading, writing, computer, or math, and also our GED HSED program, adults who want help preparing for high school diploma.
And last year was your 50-year anniversary, if I'm not mistaken. What's the history of the network?
We started out with as a very small program working with basic literacy, and over this time have expanded dramatically to include group ESL classes, ESL tutoring, GED tutoring, citizenship classes. So we've really been able to serve a lot of individuals in the community over 50 years.
Yeah, it's great. How did you get involved in this? I'm going to ask you both this question. And Marie, as long as you're talking, let's keep it going. How did you get involved in this type of work?
I've been working in adult basic education all of my career, for a long time in Philadelphia and then here in Madison, working with adults who want to build up their skills and develop the credential they need for their next steps. So I've been doing it for a long time.
Yeah. Bex, what about you?
Yeah, my interest first started when I was serving as a Peace Corps volunteer in southern China, teaching English as a second language at a university there. And I just fell in love with serving students in that capacity and this field as well. So when I returned, I applied to Literacy Network as an intern. That was in 2015. And since then, I have taken on many different roles, from intern to instructor, manager, and now currently my role as a director.
Yeah. How would you what's the definition of literacy? It's not being able to read or write, and includes other things as well.
Right. Yeah, literacy is a skill, and it could be reading and writing, but we also talk about things like digital literacy, so being able to navigate a computer in a way that supports your everyday activities. We talk about workplace literacy, having the language skills you need at your job, things like healthcare literacy, being able to navigate doctor's appointments and things like that. So broadly, I would say that it's those skills that you need, language specifically, but even outside of language, that serve your everyday goals and get you what you need in your everyday life.
You know, I think for a lot of people may assume that literacy is that illiteracy, let's put it that way, is a thing of the past, or that only non-native speakers have trouble functioning in English. But that is far from the truth, Marie.
Yes, there continues to be a need for adults who want to build basic skills in reading and writing, computer, math, to be able to do the kinds of things that they want to do in their communities, in their jobs, for next steps in certifications or degrees. So it is not a thing of the past. We have a continuing need that we are working on here in Madison.
And we have, I mean, just statewide, there are a lot of, I mean, you're working with 55,000 folks in the Dane County area. But statewide, I saw a number that was something like 1 million people within the state. That'd be like 1 in 5, thereabouts.
1 in 7 adults in 7. Wisconsin struggle with low literacy, and 1 in 4 adults in Wisconsin struggle with basic math.
So there is a definite need. And how can someone's, I'm thinking about, man, how your life is going to really blossom if you can improve your literacy, if you have a high rate.
Yeah, definitely. Students who participate in our programs have dreams like advancing their careers, maybe their position, but also their earnings. Getting a diploma or certificate, as Marie said, things like supporting their children's education, being able to go to parent-teacher conferences, for example, doing things like deepening their civic engagement, for example, voting as U.S. citizens. It really touches every aspect of someone's life.
Yeah, and not only the individual, but I think the communities in which they live. Wouldn't you say, Bex?
Yeah, definitely. Our students often want to participate more fully and even volunteer in their local communities and give back in ways that are meaningful to them. So it definitely goes beyond the individual.
Yeah, I would definitely think that. Well, we've just talked about how many people would benefit from literacy, and I want to get into more detail about how people may become involved in literacy, and we're probably also going to take a look at maybe some examples. You might be thinking of some examples of, without mentioning names, obviously, of people who have benefited from the program, and we'll do that. But we're first going to take a quick look at the news and find out what else is in store for us here on WPR News. Bex Fabrizio, one of our guests, the other Marie Nibby, with the Literacy Network. It's great to have them with us, and we'll talk some more and go into some more depth after we take a look at the news. Stay with us. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're talking now about literacy on the show. And our two guests today are from the Literacy Network. It's based in Dane County. They are Bex Fabrizio and Marie Nibby. Bex is the director of English as a second language group classes at Literacy Network, and Marie is director of adult basic education programming and GED instruction at Literacy Network. And as we talk with our guests, I hope you'll join in. Do you or someone close to you struggle with literacy? Maybe your community, does it have a community literacy program? Maybe let us know what you've done to improve your own reading and communication skills. Give us a call. Number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Marie, somebody was wondering how the Literacy Network is actually funded.
We have a wide range of funding sources through grants and individual donors and city and United Way. We have a wide range of sources.
And could you talk about, I mean, you're director of adult basic education programming. Could you talk more about the specific programs that you do? And then, Bex, I'll ask you the same question.
Yeah, great. Our essential literacy tutoring program is for adults who want to build basic skills in reading, writing, computer, math. People reach out to us, and our program manager for that program meets with them, determines what they need to work on, what their goals are, and then they're placed with a trained volunteer that meets with them once a week for 2 hours to work on what they need for their goals. And in the GED-HSED program, we work with adults who want to complete their diploma. We have tutors that meet one-on-one once a week for 2 hours to help people either study for the exams or with HSED coursework. And we also have tutors that are in the classroom supporting students during class time in the HSED classes.
And so there's a fair amount, I mean, there's some class training and so forth, but there's also a fair amount of individualized instruction here that we're talking about.
Yes, exactly. Our tutors are all in essential literacy or GED-HSED. Our tutors are all working one-on-one with individuals to help them with specifically what their goals are and what they need help with.
Yeah. And Bex, you're director of English as a second language. You have those group classes. Talk about those folks you work with and what you provide.
Absolutely. So we serve about 1,400 adults each year, and that service can take one of two main forms. It could be group class instruction, where we have an experienced trained instructor lead classes of about 20 or 25 students. We also have a tutoring format, much like in Marie's department, where a tutor will deliver a custom lesson plan to the student in a one-on-one format. And some of the programs that we offer as part of our English as a Second Language services include our leveled classes all the way from basic, like, hello, my name is, the alphabet, all the way up to college prep classes. We also have citizenship classes, workplace English classes, and community English classes, which happen in schools, libraries, and community centers throughout Dane County. And just a little bit about our students. We have students participating with us from 90 plus home countries, and they are speakers of 60 plus home languages. So we love serving that diverse range.
Wow. That's an amazing number, Bex. Oh, that's a lot of There are a lot of differences, and you're talking about 90 or so different countries involved. For example, their experiences and what they bring to bear, you need to, I would guess, sort of adjust to the sort of background that they come from.
Absolutely, yes. At the heart of our mission is being able to have student-centered instruction, which means learning about their goals and needs and also their educational experience, or perhaps they don't have much formal education experience. They might even be pre-literate in their home language, and then tailoring their education with us accordingly.
Wow. Terry in Appleton has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Terry.
Hi there. I'm on the board of Fox Valley Literacy here in Appleton, and I just today started my tutoring experience, and I'm so excited. What you have been talking about is very reminiscent of what we do up here. One of the cool things we've done, we've been expanding and growing every year. And from 2023 to 2024, we nearly doubled our intake and our instruction. It's been a very exciting time up here.
It sounds wonderful. Well, the fact that you're doubling must mean that you've had some successes, Terry.
We have. It's been incredible. The successes are countless, as your guests can attest to. One of them that sticks out in Appleton is that we have some of our students now joining our board, so they can help provide instruction and guidance and insights on their experiences with literacy and their learning. One of those students just recently went off the board and started her education and is enrolled at the UW Law School. So it's just so exciting.
Oh, Terry, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, Marie, comment on what Terry had to say.
Well, it's really exciting to hear what's going on up in Fox Valley. One thing that I wanted to respond to is we have a student leadership council here at Literacy Network where we're involving some of the students in our programs in leadership opportunities, like your caller was describing. The student leadership council meets once a month, and they help with writing grants, with public speaking on behalf of Literacy Network. They weigh in on a lot of decisions that we make at the organization, and we find it really, really helpful to have their voice in the decisions that we make.
Yeah. Well, let's talk. You mentioned, I think both have mentioned, trained volunteers. Maybe, Bex, you can talk about this because you've kind of gone through the whole process the way it sounds. How does one... Or what skills does somebody need to be a trained volunteer?
Yeah, that's a great question. We couldn't do everything that we do without volunteers. And we have a pretty wide range of volunteer opportunities here. So the skills, of course, depend on the volunteer position. But one of our most popular volunteer roles is as a tutor. And that could be a tutor for an English as a second language student in one of those departments, or it could be in one of Marie's departments working with a native English speaker. And I think some of the most important aspects or skills for volunteers that want to tutor are things like patience and understanding, a curiosity about learning from the student about their past experiences or what they're bringing to the classroom.
Yeah, anything to add there, Marie?
Well, we really appreciate the volunteers who are flexible. The learners are adults. They have complicated lives, and we really appreciate the flexibility that our tutors bring and just the investment. Typically meeting students are meeting with the same tutor over the semester, so they're building a relationship. They're getting to know the person, and that investment is really significant.
Do you guys provide sort of some basic training, or what kind of training do you provide volunteers?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. We do tutor training at the beginning of the semester for new tutors coming in. And we provide resources throughout the semester through in-services and other opportunities for ongoing tutors to continue to build and refine their skills throughout the semester.
John wonders, what makes a good tutor?
What makes a good tutor? Some of the characteristics that Bex just described, for sure. For ESL tutoring, the individuals do not need to speak another language. Through tutor training, we give them some best practices for how to work with somebody, helping them build their English skills. Same thing with our essential literacy or our GEDHSED program. Through tutor training, we're going over best practice and also giving them options of different kinds of materials. We provide the lesson plan for one-on-one tutoring, so tutors don't need to write their own lesson plan. Our staff or trained interns provide an individual lesson plan for each student each week.
Yeah, amazing. I'm wondering, you talked about high school completion in Wisconsin. I mean, are there some standard pathways? What are the pathways to high school completion in Wisconsin? And how do you help that process?
That's a great question. There's more than one pathway to high school completion in Wisconsin, which is really terrific. People can study for the standard GED timed computer-based exams. But in Wisconsin, they can also choose to take a competency-based program, which is where students are studying the same material, same content, resulting also in a diploma. But instead of a timed computer-based exam, they take classes free at Madison College or the other technical colleges throughout the state and demonstrate the competencies through assignments and things that they are writing that they submit to complete the same subjects that they would do for GED. So that means here in Wisconsin, people have a range of options, and the competency-based program is a really helpful choice, especially for anybody with any kind of language or learning differences. They can go at a pace that works for them, and we support students who are working with either of those paths.
I'm wondering about home life and thinking kind of about parents and the children. How are children affected when they have a parent who struggles with literacy?
Parents' literacy level significantly impacts children's literacy level. We know that from research. And we also see, as well as parents being able to help their children with homework and with the skills that they need in life, also modeling the importance of education. I hear often from students who come in when I'm talking to them about what brought them to our program. Often they will tell me that they want to show their kids that education is important.
Yeah, that makes a good amount of sense to me. Marie, I know you probably both have some stories about student goals and success, and maybe start with you, Marie. Can you give us some examples?
Absolutely. We really love telling some of the stories because our students are doing such extraordinary things. I can think of two students in the GEDHSED tutoring program. One student is an individual who started in the fall working with us. She's taking classes in the competency-based program. She told us she was out of school for 40 years and decided to come back and work on her HSED. She started in the fall, finished up classes in the spring. She'll graduate in June, and she's already enrolled to start taking classes at Madison College in Human Services. And I'm thinking of another student who started in our ESL group classes, then moved into our ESL one-on-one tutoring. She also worked with a tutor in our citizenship tutoring program, gained her citizenship last year, and then started working on her HSED in the fall. We'll finish up this spring, and we'll be graduating in May. So we really appreciate the opportunity to see students go through several of our programs on their journey to reach the goals that they have.
Oh, the wonderful stories. And Bex, I'm going to get to you as well. But just a reminder, as you listen in today, we're talking about literacy programs in our state with Bex Fabrizio, Director of English as a Second Language in the Literacy Network of Dane County. Marie Nibby is Director of Adult Basic Education Programming and GED Instruction at the Literacy Network. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining in today on WPR News. Coming up in a few minutes, we'll be talking about a group that's promoting Wisconsin authors. And then tomorrow on the show, we'll talk about the cost of having clean waters, and then we'll have some research on that. And then we'll learn about building wildlife habitats. That's tomorrow. Right now, we're taking a look at literacy in our state. There are 1 in 7 people here in Wisconsin who have some needs in the literacy area. And the group that we're talking about, or the members of the group we're talking about today, are from the Literacy Network of Dane County. Bex Fabrizio, Director of English as a Second Language at the network, and Marie Nibby, Director of Adult Basic Education Programming and GED Instruction at the network. And Bex, I hope you can talk with us about some of the successes you've had.
Yes, I would love to. Thanks for asking. So one story I wanted to be sure to share was about a student I had the pleasure of teaching myself, and she participated in our community English program starting in spring 2020. What a time to start her education journey. Right. Yes.
My goodness.
And she started with us because she wanted to improve her English to return to her career in pharmacy, which she had been in pharmacy in her home country of Nepal, but she had put that on hold while raising her 2 children. And she came to us to return to that career and gain confidence in her English skills. She studied with us both in group classes and one-on-one tutoring for about 40 hours over the course of 4 semesters. And then she started applying for jobs. She started practicing mock interviews, email communication, note-taking, and also some cultural, multicultural skills like making a good first impression, or differences between making a good first impression in the U.S. versus her home country. And then after months of hard work, she was able to be offered and accept a position at a pharma solutions organization doing data entry in her field of choice.
Oh, that's a great success story. Christina in Glenwood City has something for us. Christina, hi.
Hi there. Thank you. I know several people who I communicate either through their children or the language app on their phone. So I'm wondering, is this program available everywhere? And how do you go about learning more about it or getting in contact with somebody?
Good question.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Was that?
I can answer that one. This is Bex. Yeah.
Yeah, I can answer that.
So Literacy Network serves anyone in Dane County, but we're part of a larger organization called Wisconsin Literacy that's statewide. And what they do is connect literacy networks like ours, but also others across the state that offer similar services. So my recommendation for anyone with this question is to check out Wisconsin Literacy's website and take a look at what literacy councils are available to you more locally. I know one of them is Fox Valley, which we heard a listener call in earlier about that organization.
Yeah. I'm wondering, how do you, and thanks, Christina, for calling. Appreciate it. How do you make your services known to the public? I mean, in some cases, those who might need it most might be difficult to reach.
Yes, absolutely. Yep, there are inherent language barriers in reaching our target population. I think one thing we've learned over the past 50 years is that the most compelling way that we get new students is by word of mouth. So that could be a family, friend, or neighbor who is a student with us inviting others, you know, that have a similar experience, similar needs, to join them as well. That's, I think, the most compelling way people find out about our services. But we also work with libraries, schools, and community centers to get the word out. And we also try to make our material available in multiple languages, Spanish especially, but others as well. And then also using plain English that could be accessible for someone who is at a very beginner level of understanding English.
Hmm. Someone else, and I'm wondering about costs before I go on to the next question. Do people have to pay for this service?
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked. So all of our programs are free to students. The instruction is free. Some of our programs do have a required textbook. The maximum cost of a textbook is $40, but we also have scholarships. So it's never a barrier to participate. If someone isn't able to purchase the textbook, if that's not affordable, we will give them a scholarship, and the whole educational journey could be totally free.
Oh, that's great. And another emailer wondered about, you mentioned, Bex, you mentioned health literacy, and wondering how do you go about teaching health literacy or what's involved?
Absolutely. When we talk about health literacy, we want to give students the skills and confidence they need to communicate with healthcare workers. And it really depends on the level of the student, how we go about that. So for some beginner English as a second language students, that might be things like helping them understand how to describe symptoms and the language around that, how to fill out forms that they might have at the doctor's office, everything that goes into making a doctor's appointment, attending the appointment, and then understanding any follow-ups. That all takes a certain level of English and understanding, and we're able to support students by breaking down each of those steps.
Yeah. And another emailer is wondering, do you ever work with incarcerated people to help them with literacy, or are you aware of programs that do so?
We are not working directly with incarcerated individuals, but we do provide support for folks when they are back in the community, and we have folks in essential literacy and in high school completion that need to build up basic skills, need to get familiar with basic computers, need to complete a diploma, and we'll help connect them with what they need for their high school diploma or work with a tutor in our literacy program, and we find out the specific things that they need to work on as their reentry process is going on, and what they want to work on, we'll weave those things into their lesson plan.
Sounds like you're doing wonderful work, and in fact, you've proven it to me in our conversation today, Bex and Marie. Thank you both very much for being with us today to talk about the Literacy Network in Dane County, but also across the state as well. Really appreciate your time and hope we can do this again. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us.
Bex Fabrizio is Director of English as a Second Language at the Literacy Network, and Marie Nibby directs Adult Basic Education and GED Instruction at the Literacy Network. Great to have them with us. And thank you for joining us, and stay with us. We're going to be talking about a group that's promoting Wisconsin authors next. I'm Larry Mueller. Well, they say that everyone has a story to tell, but if you want to tell yours well, you should probably look for experienced writers to help you out. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Our next guest is Luella Schmidt. She's president of the Wisconsin Writers Association and co-founder and co-host of the Midwest Writers Room podcast. She writes fiction and essays about culture, democracy, justice, and history. And it's really great to have her with us today. And as we talk with her, I hope you'll join in. Are you a member of a writers group or maybe a member of the Wisconsin Writers Association? How's being a member helped you as a storyteller? What questions do you have about improving your writing? We'd love to hear from you. You can join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Luella Schmidt, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Nice to be here, Larry. Hi.
So let's talk about the Wisconsin Writers Association first. A little of their history. Celebrated 75 years in 2023. How did it all get started? And fill us in on some of the details.
Sure. So we were formed originally in 1948 by Robert Gard. He was a very, very in love with the Wisconsin idea, which is, of course, that, you know, education should influence people's lives beyond the boundaries of any classroom. And he was very inspired by such an idea. And when he originally founded the organization, it was called the Wisconsin Rural Writers Association. And almost immediately, there were poets and memoirists, fiction and history writers all expressing an interest. And I think within the first year of its existence, they were publishing and distributing collections of writings. They were publishing and distributing a newsletter and sponsoring an annual writing contest. And so since that time, the name changed one more time, I think in 1956, to become Wisconsin Regional Writers Association. And then again in 2011, finally, we became Wisconsin Writers Association.
Thinking back, as you mentioned, Bob Gard, I interviewed him quite a few times over the length of his career. He was around for a long, long time and did a lot of great things.
Yeah,
man, what a great guy. How many members do you have?
I think we're sitting at around 630 active members right now.
Okay, and I, as I understand it, this membership has grown a lot since 2020.
Yeah, it really has. I think if I remember right, our growth was something like, I think I have it nearby, something like 300% over that period. It was really kind of astounding. And, you know, of course, technology and everyone's comfort with you know, learning via Zoom really kind of exploded around 2020 because of necessity. And I think that really helped. It helped us reach a lot more people and helped a lot more people participate in the programs that we offer.
Yeah, I was thinking about that too. I've interviewed a number of authors in this past year or so. Most of those books were written during COVID.
Yep. Popular activity.
So the mission of the organization is help people become better?
Basically our mission is to encourage, educate, celebrate, and promote writers. So it's a joy to do all of those things.
It's got to be. So in 2020, the group launched the Wisconsin or WWA Press and has since published a couple of books. Why did you decide to get into the publishing business?
I think it was just a natural extension of furthering our mission and being another outlet for members to have to get their words out there. You know, we really want to be a place where stories from and about Wisconsin can come to life. And so our original couple of published works were, you know, one was Gravedigger's Daughter, which was just a lovely
collection. Deborah Ray King.
Deborah Ray King, a really lovely collection of short stories and her, it was a memoir, you know, of her childhood growing up and, you know, what it means to pass down so many of those traditions, particularly country, rural traditions. And she just made that time come alive. And then the second book that we published was Red Road Redemption by PJ Pamela Fullerton. And that too was her, you know, more rural recollections. Her story, her book is more short stories that are set in rural Wisconsin and feature all kinds of farm animals and non-farm animals throughout, and her just kind of bitter, sweet, and lovely recollections of just the people that populate those areas. Rural areas of the state.
Bob Gard would have liked both those collections.
I really think he would have. Yes, I really do. And the next one is we're having another publication that's just coming out next week, which is by a retired teacher, Sue Levy Kies. And her memoir is entitled My Homecoming Dance, Reflections on Teaching in Wisconsin. And so she actually has her book launch is coming up on June 11th at the Platteville High School or at the Platteville Library. So that's very exciting. And she basically weaves together, you know, her own, she went to school, you know, her own high school years there and then later was a teacher there. And so her memoir is just this lovely weaving together of those two kind of stories and what it was like to go there and then be the teacher. And so that should be a great read for
folks. That's pretty cool. How do you select the books that you publish?
Well, we have a submissions process, just like any other publisher. Our website is wiwrite.org, and you can submit, see the guidelines, you know, what the guidelines are. We're always looking for, you know, fiction, nonfiction. We're open on genre so much as long as it, you know, highlights Wisconsin.
I like that part of it, too, highlighting Wisconsin. Do you have to be a member? You don't have to be a member, do you, of the Wisconsin Writers Association, or do you?
You do not have to be a member. I'd be pretty surprised. It's only $35 a year, so it's probably worth it. But we don't have a rule that says you have to be a member to be published.
Well, let's talk about that. Well, maybe first, just to go along the lines of the books that you're publishing, what happens with the books once they're published? I'm thinking about being publicizing and stuff. Is that on the writer herself or himself?
It is a combined joint effort. It certainly is true that the writer has a lot on their shoulders to get out and promote the book themselves. Nobody can talk about it with as much fervor and love as the writer themselves. But our job is to assist with that, send out press releases, come up with a media kit for them to then use and help, you know, help with back cover blurbs and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Thinking some, I gave a talk once to the published writers for the University of Wisconsin Press about how to be interviewed before, during, and after.
Yeah.
Which was a lot of fun and maybe a kind of an eye-opening thing for a few people. I do about 50 interviews a year.
I'll have to go look that up after we're done.
With authors. I don't know if they videotaped that or taped that, recorded it or not, but it was a lot of fun to do it. There was a lot of writers there. So the publicist, yeah, you're right about it. You've got to really be a little more than a little proactive on your own.
Correct. Even the big publishing houses kind of expect writers these days to have a website, to have some kind of social media presence that is just a more of a must-have these days than it used to be.
Yeah. So where does your group's revenue come from?
Well, primarily we are membership-driven, and then we also do have we have some sponsorship dollars that come in. We have an annual conference that we do every year that is a significant source of our revenue. We also are, a general nonprofit and therefore get, general donations as well. Some of the programs we offer, there are small fees entailed. For example, we do an annual writing contest called the Jade Ring, and there's, a small entrance fee for that. And so pretty much pretty self-contained funding at the moment, paying for ourselves out of our own programs and services.
So what? Tell me some more about the creative writing program that you have.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was a great idea, by the way, to have.
Yeah. So we are almost entirely volunteer run. And so we have a board of directors that meets, about once a month, and people bring their ideas. And, if it seems like it fits our mission and we have the bandwidth, we'll try to roll something out and give it a try. And we rolled out the creative writing program in particular because there just seemed to be a need for some of those basics, the idea of choosing what tense should I choose when I'm writing? What point of view should I use and why? And, other narrative devices, how to structure your narrative, for example, how to create compelling characters. And so the first run through of our creative program, writing program, went through more of those basics that are good for novices, but also good refreshers for more experienced writers. And then we do have another program, another session of the program running, I believe it's coming up in the fall, where we'll focus a little more on more advanced topics. So,
all good. Luella Schmidt, our guest today, president of the Wisconsin Writers Association. Questions about the association or about writing? I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mailer for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. We're taking a look at writing and the Wisconsin Writers Association with its president, Luella Schmidt. Great to have her with us. First time I think I've talked with her, with you, Luella. Yeah,
yeah,
you're
correct.
Nodding yes in agreement. I don't think we've talked before. But it's fun having you with us today. Questions for her or maybe an experience to share, I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you can email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. The conference, I took a look at the upcoming conference. It's not till fall, but probably worth getting some background on it. Give us the when's and the what's going on. I thought, wow, a lot of really good talks and really good information that any writer could use.
Yeah, for sure. Every year we travel to a different part of the state, and this year it's October 25th and 26th in beautiful La Crosse. I can't wait. We have keynotes lined up by Lon Samantha Chang, who is heads up the Iowa Writers Workshop, and bestselling novelist Ann Garvin, both doing keynotes. And we also have a little book club event that we're working on. It's coming up in July, where we're going to try to read the novels or the works of our two keynotes and then get together as members and discuss them and get a little excitement going. At the conference itself, you know, there's opportunities for practice pitches. So, you know, before you go and then can do a one-on-one pitch session with actual agents. There will be an agent panel where they can tell us kind of what they are looking for, what kind of books they're looking for to fill their list. There will be a vendor and a book fair where people can sell their books. Ann Garvin will be doing a masterclass for us. There's opportunities to do one-on-one critiques of your work. And, you know, one of the things I am a co-host, as you mentioned, of the Midwest Writers Room podcast, and Ken Humphrey and I have heard, you know, every author that we've interviewed have said over and over again that having a critique group is the single biggest thing that kind of gave them a jump, a leg up on their work, because you're kind of forced to share your precious writing with other people and have them do it back to you. And I remember the first time I did it, I was terrified. I mean, I think it's okay to say that, you know, it's okay to say that it's hard, but it's so valuable. And we're going to have some of that at the conference. There will be a publisher panel where we can, their topic is basically how to make it out of the slush pile. And then, of course, full of breakout sessions. We broke them out this year between novice craft, advanced craft, and then a third track, which is marketing and publishing. So lots of really great information.
Yeah, it sounded great to me. Carolyn DePere has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Carol.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just have a comment. I'd like your group to be aware that a lot of us can't read a print copy any longer, and we depend on audiobooks. I recently heard an author speaking about her Wisconsin title, and it sounded really interesting, but she didn't have anything other than the print paper book. And I suggested that a lot of times a Wisconsin author might be reading their own title, so they're not using a separate voice over.
Yeah, yeah. Carol, thanks for calling. A comment on that, Luella.
Yeah, I think, you know, for our WWA Press novels, or excuse me, books, they're not all novels, we have not done audiobooks for them yet. Again, we're pretty new at this and just, you know, bringing out our third title, but I can't agree with Carol more. You know, audiobooks, whether you need them because of sight or not, are just such a great way to consume these works. And so I definitely agree that audiobooks are helpful. It's difficult. It's more difficult. It's another thing we have to learn how to kind of do. You know, it's a different medium to get them out there. But I think it's worth the work, worth the effort.
Yeah, there are a lot of people. Jill Nadeau is one of them, who our producer, our executive producer for today, loves audiobooks. And
yeah.
I'm not a great one to for an audiobook. I'd rather have the book and be able to look at it. But a lot of people are. So I'm glad to know you're given that some thought for down the road. Kristen in Lake Mills. Thank you for calling, Kristen. What's on your mind?
Hi there. I was wondering if the WWA has taken any position or has had any discussions or programs on the AI large language models like ChatGPT. And use of those, that new technology by writers.
So we have not had any WWA-sponsored events about AI yet. I will tell you that our director of operations and I both attended a webinar about ChatGPT and how that particular webinar was about how to use it as a writer, not for your writing, but to help you kind of idea generate and help you think through character work. And the gist of the webinar was basically how to learn how to feed it the proper prompts so that you can get out of it what you want out of it. And that was really interesting. And we've had a couple of discussions about whether, how to approach that, if we could maybe ask that individual to come and present for us. But it is a hot topic. There are a lot of writers who feel that even using it to idea generate is cheating. I respect for you if that's what you believe. And certainly, there's a lot of, the most that we've done, I think, as an organization is just say in our submission that, you're not allowed to use it.
Yeah.
So that's as far as we've gotten. But it's an excellent question. It is a hot topic. I came across a meme that I wanted to share with Kristen and with you all, and it was basically like, I want AI to do my chores and my laundry so that I have time to create art, not use AI to create art so I have more time to do my chores.
That's a great one. I love that.
Yeah.
Oh, Kristen, thank you so much for calling. Well, it does sound like it's definitely on your radar, and it's something that...
It has to be.
Yeah, you're going to be... You have a list on your website of a number of writing groups around the state. Why do you think so many people want to write?
Oh, boy, what a good question. Well, I think for a lot of folks, I've read a lot of people who say, I don't even know what I think until I write about it. It's a way of processing. That is certainly true for me. I am about midway through a novel, and one of the things that is so fun to watch happen, I will sit there with that blank screen and the cursor blinking at me, mocking me, and suddenly something out of nowhere that I didn't intend on putting in there will just come to me, and it just takes a shape that feels like it's outside of your control, which is such a lovely and addictive feeling to have. So I think there's something in the spiritual side of it, and there's also just something in the practical side that writing really can help people process things.
Yeah, I've heard a number of authors kind of say pretty much the same thing, looking at that blank page, and then something pops up. Where the heck did that come from? But you don't ask any questions. You just bang away.
Thank you. Gracious, I shall take it.
So you've got that list. What else are people going to find on your website? And the website, we've got it up on our page, but what's the website?
WIWrite.org. So basically... our member benefits are kind of what you'll find on the website. And so, for members, we offer, a free online Zoom event every month. That's basically going to be something like a workshop, maybe on how to launch your book, or it'll be a night of poetry. We also do periodic Zoom open mic nights. Speaking of which, there will be a live open mic night at the conference as well, which is always a real fun thing to do. And we also have a book review program. That is like one of our most popular member benefits, where basically authors are able to submit their book to us, and we work with volunteer readers and help get them reviews, which is just an incredibly powerful way to increase your visibility. And we also, of course, publish 3 times a year. We publish Creative Wisconsin Magazine. That is also something you can read on our website. And that is a literary magazine featuring writers that are members and non-members, and kind of sharing the latest news, things to be aware of upcoming in the state and around the state. What else? I also wanted to mention another program that we added recently, which is critique group sessions. And so these are basically six sessions where you can, you know, join a critique group that is led by an established writer to give and receive feedback. And so it's a great way to practice that. You know, giving and receiving are both really helpful tools for any writer to give and receive feedback.
That is really cool. And you mentioned the membership. What is it? $35, is it?
$35 a year. That's it.
So that's just forego one night out for dinner, and you got more than enough to cover the cost of it. Boy, oh boy. And the Midwest Writers Room podcast, here we are getting up a bit to time, but tell us about that podcast and how's it going?
Good. That was an idea by our former president, Barry Whiteman. And at the time, I think it didn't get a lot of, I think there was just a lot of things going on with our organization, and it kind of lingered and didn't, you know, wasn't really happening. And I couldn't get it out of my mind because I'm a big podcast listener myself. And so I threw out there the idea that I'd be willing to try it. And my friend Ken Humphrey said, I'd be willing to do it too. And so once you got two people willing to do that work, then it's kind of, it feels less like work. And so we alternate between interviewing authors and interviewing industry experts, you know, people that want to talk about marketing, book marketing, or people that want to talk about publishing or things like that. And so it's been really fun to get to know all of these amazing writers. We're surrounded by such great talent.
Oh, I love it. The Larry Mueller Show Book Club. But we go with Wisconsin authors, or that the book has to be set in pretty much in Wisconsin, or we're not going to use it. Luella, a great pleasure to talk with you. Boy, that time flew. Let's do it again. Sure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Luella Schmidt, president of the Wisconsin Writers Association and co-founder and co-host of the Midwest Writers Room podcast. The Writers Association website is wiwrite.org. Great to have her along. On the show tomorrow, we'll be talking sports, take a look at the new women's fast pitch softball division of Wisconsin Northwoods Association, then a documentary about flat track motorcycle racing. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.